Hello and welcome to this ACE Oncocast recorded in Budapest on the occasion of the European Multidisciplinary Congress on Urological Cancers. This podcast series is entitled Expert Review, Immunotherapy in Urothelial Cancer, When, Why and How. My name is Rob Coleman and I'm a medical oncologist at the University of Sheffield in the United Kingdom. And I'm delighted to be joined today by two leading urothelial cancer experts, Dr. Tom Poles from the St. Bart's Cancer Centre, London, and Dr. Aristotelis Bamias from the University of Athens in Athens, Greece. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for joining me today. In today's ACE Oncocast, our clinical experts will be discussing neoadjuvant and adjuvant treatment strategies for high-risk and locally advanced urothelial cancer. We're going to start with the management of high-risk, locally advanced urothelial cancers and the roles of systemic therapy, either as neoadjuvant or adjuvant therapy. Tom, let's start by considering the neoadjuvant management of urothelial cancers, that those large tumours or locally advanced disease, potentially operable, where neoadjuvant chemotherapy has really been the standard of care for some while, but there have been developments with immunotherapy in that setting. Where are we, and you know, what is the role of immunological treatments in the neoadjuvant setting?
So in the neoadjuvant setting, unlike the adjuvant setting, we don't yet have any randomised data. We have phase two data, and that data looks actually promising. So half a dozen, probably more, single arm studies of 20 or 30 patients. In fact, the largest is 100 patients. Andrea Necki, 120 patients. We've got Abacus, atezolizumab, pembrolizumab. And they both show pathological CR rates between 30 and 40%. And that's about the same as chemotherapy. So single agent atezolizumab, single agent pembrolizumab, path CR about the same as chemotherapy. And then there was more data with the combination of different immune therapies, but the path CR rate doesn't seem much higher than that with the combination, actually. And then chemotherapy plus immune therapy, and again, the path CR rate's between 30 and 40%. So we've got a whole string of phase two trials, promising data, tolerable data, but no clear winner at this point. And we've launched seven randomized phase three studies. And those randomized phase three studies include single agent immune therapy, immune combinations, even triplets with antibody drug conjugates, chemotherapy combinations. So there's a plethora of neoadjuvant randomized phase three studies, which we'll report over the next 2 or 3 years.
Okay, thank you. And Aris, in your practice, how do you manage such patients?
Well, we want to give them neoadjuvant chemotherapy. We all know the problems of underutilization of this standard. We are also participating in some of the trials that Thomas mentioned. So it's early days regarding the role of immunotherapy in this setting.
Okay. So we need to watch this space on that area, and I guess it's going to be some years before these big phase three trials read out. So let's move to the adjuvant setting, the post-operative setting. And Aris, what are your selection criteria that you use for picking a patient for adjuvant therapy? And, you know, what's the role of immune checkpoint inhibitors in high-risk disease?
The risk factors for a patient who has undergone a radical cystectomy for relapse is the T stage, is the end stage. So any T3 or T4 patient and plus is in high risk of relapsing. That is for patients who did not have neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Now, for patients who had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, we know that any T equal or above 2 is a high risk for relapse. So these are the patients who, in practice, but also in randomized trials, have been included in these trials because they present with high risk of relapse. These patients, up to very recently, we used cisplatin-based chemotherapy. To be honest, I still use it to patients who can get cisplatin, and there is a sizable proportion of patients who can't. These patients certainly are candidates to be offered adjuvant nivolumab after the CheckMate results. Of course, we don't have overall survival data from this study. So although the DFS looks very promising and other sub-analyses are very convincing, I use nivolumab routinely now in patients who had neoadjuvant chemotherapy and they have a T2 or more. These patients, in fact, we know they did not do well on chemotherapy. They will relapse very soon and they will get immunotherapy then. So I think that this group of patients can be offered straight away after cystectomy adjuvant nivolumab.
And how much did that group of patients benefit with the use of adjuvant nivolumab in the CheckMate study?
The hazard ratio was very promising. I cannot recall now the exact number for this particular group, but up to now, with this follow-up of this study, it seems that the positive result is driven by this population.
Right, right, okay. And Tom, we have IMvigor010 and probably other studies. I mean, is CheckMate 274 just a lucky winner, or is it, where are we with the totality of the evidence?
I don't think it's a lucky winner. And the reason why that's the case is because the p-value is very statistically significant. The chance of it happening by luck alone is, you know, less than 1 in 100, and it's the first trial to, or the second trial to read out. So I don't think it's a black swan event in that respect. I think nivolumab has gone against placebo. Atezolizumab, which was a negative trial, went against best supportive care. And there's some subtle differences in that. There's different censoring in the early part of the trial, particularly the atezolizumab study, that may reflect patients on the placebo control arm coming off early because they knew they weren't randomised or something active. So there is something in the trial design there. There's also, of course, different mechanisms of action of the drugs, which requires consideration. But when you put those two trials together and you look at immune checkpoint inhibitors and urothelial cancers, and there are more similarities than differences. Mm-hmm. It is difficult to explain why one's positive and one's negative for DFS. And the fact the atezolizumab study does not have overall survival, and the fact we've not yet seen overall survival for the nivolumab trial, is creates concern for me. That's the first thing. I think the other thing we have to talk about is the EMA has approved the nivolumab only in PD-L1 positive patients. Right. And the FDA has approved it in all comers. And that inconsistency also concerns me. In bladder cancer, we've got a history of inconsistencies by the agencies. You might remember frontline atezolizumab and pembrolizumab were approved in metastatic disease in all comers, and then we had to change the label. In fact, we've changed things twice. Mm. And so we've been hasty in bladder cancer before. I would really have liked to seen that nivolumab overall survival signal before we jump in with both feet in the view of another negative trial. And I think the longer we wait, the more concerned I get around that issue. So that's one issue. I think I agree with Ari. I am comfortable offering patients adjuvant nivolumab in if they're PD-L1 positive, with very strong caveats. We haven't yet seen overall survival. We don't know if you can be rescued with subsequent therapy. That's what overall survival would do. And of course, we're over-treating 50% of patients who don't need the therapy. And I'm afraid the biomarker has been really inconsistent in bladder cancer. Really inconsistent. And I won't give you examples, but I can talk about it for an hour. And I'm saying, and we have to use a biomarker, which I don't believe in. So I'm actually not very satisfied with where we are currently with adjuvant immune therapy. And I think we do need to see more data. I'm excited about circulating tumor DNA. That seems to select patients at high risk. And there's a study called IMvigor011, 011, ctDNA positive patients randomized to atezolizumab or placebo after surgery. That's a really important question. Wouldn't it be lovely if those 50% of patients who aren't going to relapse don't need to go through this process? That seems a better approach than the biomarker as it currently stands. So I'm concerned that we're moving very quickly from a clinical perspective, but we haven't done the proper research yet to actually define what we need to know. And heaven forbid, if that overall survival signal in the nivolumab study doesn't come home or shows something unusual, like it seems to be okay in the PD-L1 negatives but not the PD-L1 positives, what do we do then?
Yeah. What about immunological biomarkers? There's some data, I believe, with the adjuvant nivolumab.
Yeah, so there is ongoing work in this area. And I think it's fair to say that PD-L1 is a really complicated biomarker. There's immune cell expression, there's tumor cell expression. The tumor cell expression, which is the one the nivolumab label is based around, is associated with a hazard ratio of 0.53 versus 0.70 for the ITT population. So it's only 25% of patients, it's a relatively small group. The immune cell staining, the immune cell staining seems to be more prognostic than predictive and hasn't really been that successful. There's a second generation of biomarkers coming through, tumor mutational burden, which actually looks more promising than PD-L1 in urothelial cancer, although it's never been formally tested. And then there are another group of biomarkers which are more exploratory, tertiary lymphoid structures, which essentially are groups of innate and immune cells bound together. And the topography of these, like planets in a solar system, you can identify them. In fact, you can identify them by artificial intelligence, looking at groups of immune cells together. And actually, it's likely that PD-L1 is an oversimplification, and you need to have innate and adaptive immunity functioning for immune therapy to work in bladder cancer, at least. And it may be that tertiary lymphoid structures turn out to be a better way in the future. And we might be using artificial intelligence or other platforms to identify these tertiary lymphoid structures using circulating tumour DNA as well. And this may be a much better way of selecting patients in the future. I really hope we can move away from PD-L1. Mm.
Any final comments on this topic, Aris?
No, I fully agree. The biomarkers up to now have been disappointing for urothelial cancer, and I fully agree with the skepticism on the inconsistency of the EMA and FDA approval of nivolumab in adjuvant setting, because, as I said, patients who had had neoadjuvant chemotherapy and they had a T2 after cystectomy, these patients, when they relapse, they will get actually nivolumab or something similar in a PD-L1 agnostic way. So it was sort of, you know, matter of discussion, but in any case, as you said, there has been a lot of work going on. There is a lot, many things to be learned. Yet we now from IMvigor 130, Matt Golsky has produced, and actually saw the paper yesterday, data supporting the fact that cisplatin and carboplatin had different immunomodulatory effects. So there is so much to learn, and I think without having a very good basis of knowledge how this immune system works locally in the tumor, we will not have the best biomarker to use.
Well, thank you, Tom and Aris, for this great discussion, and thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for next week's podcast as we discuss first-line and maintenance treatments for metastatic disease.